The Supreme Personality of Godhead said.
Idam.
This.
Tu.
But.
Te.
Unto you.
Guya
tamam.
The most confidential.
Pravakshami.
I am speaking.
Anasuyave.
To the non-envious.
Jnanam.
Knowledge.
Vijnanam.
Realized knowledge.
Sahitam.
With.
Yat.
Which.
Yatva.
Knowing.
Mokshase.
You will be released.
Ashubhat.
From this miserable material existence.
And the translation reads, the Supreme Personality of Godhead said, my dear Arjuna, because you are never envious of me, I shall impart to you this most confidential knowledge and realization, knowing which you shall be relieved from the miseries of material existence. So I'll reread the English translation, I say, and then you all repeat. I'll break it into smaller pieces. The Supreme Personality of Godhead said,
my dear Arjuna,
because you are never envious of me,
I shall impart to you
this most confidential knowledge
and realization,
knowing which
you shall be relieved
of the miseries of material existence. Okay. So, we're opening a new chapter here, and this chapter is called The Most Confidential Knowledge. So, right away, that's kind of interesting. Why should it be called The Most Confidential Knowledge? Why should knowledge about Krishna be confidential? Anybody have any guesses?
Because Krishna is not, like, cheaply achieved.
Okay, that's one possible thing.
He doesn't give the knowledge to the envious.
Okay, we just read it, right? Anasuyave. If you're envious, you don't get it. What other reasons?
He gives only the person those who have faith.
Okay, he gives it only to people who have faith.
You have to be looking for it.
Yeah, you have to be looking for it. That's probably the most straight ahead one. What were you going to say, Raphael?
He also gives them to
the ones that are dear to Krishna. Yeah, he gives those to those who are dear. So I think one of the things that I focus in on the most is the fact that you don't get knowledge that you don't want. Who learns about things that they don't want to learn about? Nobody. Unless, of course, you're forced to for some kind of occupational thing. Somebody, you know, tells you you've got to learn how to, you know, do corporate law or something like that. You really have no desire to do that, but your boss tells you do it. It's either that or lose a job, so you do it. But we usually do not learn things that we don't want to learn. We don't investigate things that we're not interested in. And this kind of hinges on the broader concept of faith that is there in the Vedic literature. Is more than in the Western world, the word faith has a kind of almost two-dimensional meaning, but the concept is much broader in the West. In the Vedic tradition, the idea of faith means not only that we have a trust, but we also have a focus on things, and we're involved with them in a practical way. So faith means more than just some kind of conceptual acceptance of something. So this chapter is called The Most Confidential Knowledge. In the purport, if you read it, Prabhupada reveals that chapter 1 of Bhagavad Gita is kind of an introduction to the book. 2 and 3, confidential knowledge are discussed. He says in chapters 7 and 8, more confidential knowledge is discussed. And now here we are in chapter 9, we get the most confidential knowledge, because Prabhupada says this is where Krishna reveals a pure devotional service. So in the first 6 chapters or so, we hear knowledge pertaining to liberation. And in chapter 7 and 8, we hear about devotional service. But in chapter 9, we're hearing about pure devotional service. So, at other times, I've discussed this idea that the Bhagavad Gita is broken into 3 basic sections. It has 18 chapters, so each section is 6 chapters long. So, the first 6 chapters are basically kind of an overview of Vedic knowledge. And it is, as Prabhupada describing, knowledge that gets us to understand something about liberation, particularly that we are being liberated from the body. We are not the body. We're in a body, but we are not the body. And that knowledge is basically not available in the Western world for the most part. Very few people have any conception that they're not the body. Some people may have this understanding that we are a soul, but what that actually means and how that works, that's not at all clear to most people. And in fact, religions talk about it in a very murky and confused way. You know, many modern religions suggest even that when we die, although it's quite obvious what happens to the body, sometimes the body is cut into a million pieces if you're in a plane that crashes into the ocean, or sometimes the body burns up if you're in a car that's you know, crashes into another car and flames start to come out, or the body just gets put into the ground and gradually gets eaten by all kinds of little worm friends and all that kind of stuff. So what happens when, if we have a soul, what is the soul's relationship to that thing? Some religions suggest that when, you know, there's the final judgment, the body gets put back together in some kind of miraculous way. Why we would want that exactly, I don't know, but at any rate, that's the idea. Some think that the soul is kind of formless, you know, the Casper the Friendly Ghost kind of conception, that is this wispy sort of smoke-like thing, and the soul needs a body to give it shape, to give it substance so that it can express itself in the world, but that's also not accepted by Vedic knowledge. And there's this idea that the soul and the body are the same thing, that, you know, when the body dies, that's it. There's nothing more to it than that. The soul is just some kind of electrical stuff that's flashing around in the brain. And when the body finally shuts down for the last time, that's the end of the story. That's all she wrote. You know, there's no more anything else, no more electrical current going through the brain. Therefore, there's no soul, because the soul is exactly just the electrical stuff that goes on in the body. But all these are false conceptions. In the Vedas, we learn that the soul is a substance in and of itself. And the soul is a substance that is not matter and nothing like matter. It is a very different substance. It's far more subtle than matter. We learned that even matter, earth, water, fire, air, and ether, are more progressively subtle as we go from earth to more subtle water, to more subtle air, to more subtle fire, to more subtle ether. And then we get even more subtle than ether. We go to mind, intelligence, and false ego, which are even more subtle, but they're still material. And then the soul is even more subtle than that. So the soul has shape. The soul has substance. The soul lasts forever. The soul does not play by the same rules that the physicists and chemists study. The soul is a very different thing. And it resides within the body, and it's like the driver of the car. And at the time of death, the soul leaves the body, and the body disintegrates. It's made out of various chemicals. And once the soul is out of the body, then the material world, which is like a giant recycling plant, begins to reclaim those chemicals that were in the body and use them for other things. Those chemicals pass into the earth, or they pass into the bodies of other living beings as food, etc., etc. But the soul has nothing to do with any of that. And this is not the first body the soul has been in. The soul is in countless bodies. And each time the soul lives a life in a particular body, it develops a kind of karma and a kind of pattern of desires. And then that karma and that desire pattern is transferred again to the next body when the body becomes too old or is involved in some kind of accident or some kind of violent action or just old age. The body is destroyed, the soul moves on, the body again is destroyed, the soul moves on again. And each time the soul is not harmed at all by the process of death, and the soul has nothing to do with the process of death. The soul simply, as it's mentioned in the second chapter of Bhagavad Gita, is like an air carrying aroma. The aroma is in the air, but the air actually is not the aroma. It's a different thing. It carries it. It's very subtle. So I'm simplifying. There's actually one more aspect. There's a thing we call the subtle body, which is mind, intelligence, and false ego. These are also material things, mind, intelligence, and false ego. And we should say that they're false mind, false intelligence, and false ego. And it's this false mind, false intelligence, and false ego which comprise what we call the subtle body, which also is not destroyed at death. But the subtle body carries the soul to a new gross body. And then when that gross body dies, the subtle body carries on to a new gross body. And the subtle body is changing as a result of successive births and deaths. And as it goes from various successive births and deaths, the soul changes subtly in its sense of who and what it wants to be in the material world. The subtle body picks up various ideas, and its karma changes. And that's why we take different kinds of bodies. So the soul is very happy without the gross body. And for that matter, the soul is happy without the subtle body. The soul doesn't need either of those two things. The soul is not smoke. The soul has form. But the soul's form is very tiny. It's compressed like an atomic particle. It's very tiny. And it resides in the region of the heart of the gross body. And through the gross body, the sensations come in, and they are channeled to the subtle body, and then they are channeled to the soul. And the soul is not the subtle body, the soul is not the gross body, but the soul identifies with both the subtle body and the gross body. In fact, the soul identifies with both of them so much that the soul imagines that when the gross body dies, the soul will die, when in fact that will not happen. So this is where the miseries come from. These miseries are a part of our everyday life. And we were talking about the other day, last Sunday, we were reading a part of Srimad Bhagavatam, and it was talking about, in Sanskrit, there's a listing of the various letters in the alphabet of Sanskrit. Of course, Sanskrit doesn't have an alphabet. It has a syllabary. So that means that instead of single letters in Sanskrit, there's a consonant and vowel pair. And so you have cha, cha, ja, ja, ma. Actually, it starts with, ka, ka, ga, ga, ma. So the first line of the Sanskrit syllabary starts with the ka letter, then there's ka, then there's ga, then there's ga, and then there's na. And so that's called the ka varga, or the ka line, or the ka grouping. Below that we have cha cha ja ja na, then we have ta ta da da na, then we have ta ta da da na, then we have the pa varga, which is pa pa ba ba ma. And so Prabhupada always points this out, that in the Sanskrit language, these letters stand for things. And so pavarga, the pa part of the papa baba ma, stands for parishrama, which means hard work. Then the next part, the pa with the aspiration, that one stands for pena, which means foam. And then the third one, bha, stands for bhyartata, which means, stands for bhyartata. And bhyartata means disillusion. And then we have bha with the aspiration, and that stands for bhayam, or fear. And then finally we have ma, which stands for mrityu, which means death. So this is like a sort of a character or a quick summary of life in the material world. You work hard, parishrama, so that foam comes from the mouth. And then after the foam comes from the mouth, bhyartata, you are disappointed. And finally you become afraid. And after all that, you die. It's kind of a nice sandwich, right? Pa pa ba ba ma. And in Sanskrit, this is called pavarga, you know. Each of these letters stands for one aspect of our, you know, material world and how it deploys itself. So we work hard to foam at the mouth so we can be disappointed. Later on, we become fearful after we're disappointed, and finally we die. So spiritual life lifts us above this pavarga, and so spiritual life is called apavarga. So here we find that you will be delivered from the miseries of material existence. So by engaging in devotional service, one side benefit of it is, and we call this a side benefit, even though most people would think this is the real deal, you know, getting relief from material miseries. Who doesn't want to get rid of material miseries? Of course, sometimes we kid ourselves there aren't any material miseries, but that doesn't last long. We encounter them at every turn, all sorts of things from insect bites, you know, to weather issues, to meter parking ladies and everything else. There's all these different kinds of difficulties that we face at every turn. And so that's part of the miseries of material existence. But here in this verse, we're learning that we get knowledge and realization. And in Sanskrit, those two words are jnanam and vijnanam. But before I move on to that, I don't want to cover too much territory without asking to see if there are any questions, if anybody has any questions about what we just talked about. We talked about this whole idea of not being the body, of how there are all these subtleties of the gross body. The gross body is very gross, it's very tangible, but within it is a subtle body, which is, excuse me, less tangible, and the soul is even less tangible than the subtle body. And we talked about this idea of miseries in the material world. Any question about that?
I got a little confused in the subtle body and the
And the soul. Okay. So in wintertime, this is a good time to have this example. Sometimes when we go outside, we have a regular shirt on, and then we put a coat over it. So we've got two outer layers, you know. The coat is like the gross body, and the shirt is like the subtle body. And the subtle body, as I said, is made of three elements, and they are manas, buddhi, and ahankara, or in English, mind, false mind, false intelligence, and false ego. And so this subtle body is our suitcase of mental imaginations of who we are and what we want to do in this material world. And it's also encases our karma, the things we've done in the past. And this is what gets ejected, like a, you know, airplane going down, it's in flames and the pilot ejects out. This is what ejects out the subtle body, and the subtle body encases the soul. The soul is within the subtle body. And devotional service actually is designed to dissolve the subtle body. And when the subtle body is completely dissolved, then there is no false mind, false ego, or false intelligence. And when one dies in this gross body, you do not gravitate to another gross body, but instead you leave the material world altogether and you go back to the spiritual world. Does that help to clear it up?
Yeah, a little bit. But
go ahead.
Forgive me if I'm sorry.
No, go ahead. That's why we have these questions.
Okay. So, like, my thing, like, I always was thinking that there is only soul in the body.
Yeah.
I didn't had any idea about the subtle body.
Yeah, the subtle body is called technically in Sanskrit the linga sharira. And the gross body is the stula sharira. So the gross body is this thing that we see. We have never seen the soul. And we've never seen
the
subtle body, usually. Sometimes we do see them on rare occasions. And when you see a subtle body that's out of the gross body, we commonly call that a ghost. In common everyday language is what we say. So in other words, the subtle body does have a kind of form to it. And sometimes that form may mimic the form of the gross body. But then again, it's not a permanent form, because that subtle body is a part of our imagination of who we are. And when we get finished with the subtle body, it's dissolved away and we take birth in the spiritual world. We rather go back to the spiritual world. We don't genuinely take birth there. You don't take birth there, but you just re-enter there.
Okay. So like we do bhakti and all. So that is, we are doing for the soul or for the subtle body?
For the soul. When we are doing bhakti yoga, that means that the soul is doing its original activity, which is possible to do, even now when we've got a coat and a shirt on, even now when we have a gross body and a subtle body. We can do bhakti. Usually we don't. If we don't hear about it, we don't know about it, we don't find out about it, as Krishna is saying in this verse, we don't do it. But if we do find out about it, we begin to do it, then we are acting on the platform of the soul, instead of acting on the platform of the subtle body and the needs and desires and sensations of the gross body. So usually people act on the needs and desires of the subtle body as seen through the senses of the gross body. That's what mostly people are doing. But devotional service means to not act in that way. Okay. And when that happens, eventually we lose our sense of false ego. We lose our sense of false mind. We lose our sense of false intelligence. And instead, we begin to understand that we are soul. And when we do that, we're eligible to go back to the spiritual world instead of remaining in the cycle of samsara, the cycle of reincarnation, where we reincarnate time and time and time again. Any other questions about this? Yeah.
You mentioned something about the soul having a shape.
Can
you elaborate more on that?
Well, in the spiritual world, the souls are not like Casper the Friendly Ghost. They're not some kind of blob of, some kind of luminiferous ether or something like that. They actually have a very decisive and distinct form, and that's based on their relationship with the Supreme Lord. When the soul leaves the spiritual world because of non-cooperation with the Supreme Lord, then the soul actually becomes very tiny and compresses. And it lives inside a subtle body, and that subtle body is again encased within a gross body, and that subtle body is what directs the living entity from one lifetime to another. So while we are in the material world, we are compressed down into a tiny kind of atomic spark. But when we re-enter the spiritual world, then we expand out to our original form, and we regain our original relationship with the Supreme in that original form. But right now, our original form is unknown to us because we're layered over by so much ignorance and material desire, etc. Does that help? Okay. Any other questions about this before we move on to the next segment here?
I don't know. I want to ask one thing, but I don't know whether it is related to this or not.
Okay.
They say, like, we do the bad karmas in this life.
Mm.
So the soul has to suffer, or...
Well, the soul technically never suffers, but the soul thinks that suffering is there because the soul identifies with the subtle body and the gross body. So this is something that may be hard to understand at first. Now, this is what this verse is actually talking about. That as long as we identify with the false ego, the false mind, and the false intelligence, we will also identify with the body. And because we're identifying with the gross body suffers, and we, the soul, imagine that we are suffering too. But when we do enough devotional service, we no longer identify with either the subtle body or the gross body, and therefore we do not suffer the same way. So that connection gets broken because we realize that we are not the gross body and we are not the subtle body. We are simply in a gross body, and we have a subtle body, but we don't identify with them. So then suffering is not such a difficult thing, and that's why Krishna is giving Arjuna this quote-unquote confidential knowledge. Because when you have confidential knowledge, that is jnanam. But jnanam is not enough. We have to move to the platform of vijnanam, which is realized knowledge. So you can sit in a classroom and learn about flying airplanes. You know, you can even do a simulator. But nothing is the same as actually getting in an airplane. You know, so you can hear how to perform various kinds of medical operations. You can read about them in a book. And you can do it for a long time. You can understand all the principles. But it is not the same thing as actually operating on a live human being, you know, in the theater of a, you know, surgery. So in the same way, we hear these concepts and we may little by little try to assimilate them and understand them. But we have to move beyond that to the stage of realization. And that can happen only by applying the principles of devotional service.
Practicing.
Right. So when we apply the principles of devotional service, we don't just hear these things as interesting sound vibrations that seem to make sense in a philosophical way, but we begin to actually experience what it's like to not identify with the body. We are driving a body, but we are not the body. We are driving a body, but we are not the body. And we see that the body may be experiencing some difficulty, but we think, oh, it's the body experiencing some difficulty. That's not the same thing as thinking, I'm hurting. You know, when we say, I'm hurting, I'm sad, we're identifying with the body, we're identifying with the false mind, false intelligence, and false ego. And that's why we make those statements. In fact, I am not. I am something separate from all this. But I'm identifying it, so I'm projecting all the difficulties that come to the body as my difficulties, when actually, in fact, they're not. The body will eventually get wrecked anyway, by time or by misfortune, one way or another. So this is part of this whole thing. What we'll find in the study of Krishna consciousness, particularly the philosophy that's contained here in Bhagavad Gita, is that nowhere else will you find anything that's as expansive as these ideas that are given to us in the Vedic literatures. Nowhere will you find so many philosophical issues raised and explained. Nowhere will you find something that's as cohesive, that doesn't contradict itself at every turn. And nowhere will you find anything so practical. Because once you learn these ideas, we're not here just, you know, boning up on knowledge or tossing around philosophical ideas like people playing mental chess or something like that. We're learning these ideas, and then we want to go to the next step, which is to put them into practice. And when you put them into practice, they become vijnanam, or realized. You know, so the person studying in school about flying airplanes, they learn all kinds of things, you know, about, you know, the ailerons, and they learn about the flaps, and they learn about banking, and they learn what kind of velocity you have to take off to get off the ground. They learn about different types of aircraft. They learn about airflow. They learn about turbulence. They learn all these things. But eventually, they have to actually put that knowledge into practical use in the cockpit of an aircraft, you know. And then when they do that, then all that theoretical stuff suddenly becomes very tangible, and it's immediately useful. And we begin to realize it was a reason why we did that. And so it's the same thing with religion or philosophy. Religion and philosophy should not just be speculative, you know, debative sort of understandings, but really, whatever we learn, we should try to put it into practice. If we do put it into practice, we will get the actual result right away, which we call here vijnanam, or realized knowledge. You will realize that you're not the body. If you hear these things, you don't act on them, you don't practically engage them or change your life according to the principles we're talking about, then it's a long road to hoe. You won't get much realization. You'll hear these things, it may sound good, may sound reasonable, it may sound plausible, but if you're not actually doing the processes of devotional service, then it's all theoretical still, and it'll remain that way, like the person who's studying flight school but never gets in an airplane. It's the same thing, you know, so we have to get in the airplane, and we have to actually practically do it. Any questions about that? Yeah, in the back.
People reincarnate, do they inherit the same subtle body from a previous life?
Yeah. It's the subtle body that is moved from one gross body to the next. And so the subtle body is changing, but not as quickly as the gross body. And the subtle body is basically kind of, as I was saying, the repository of these fictional ideas we have about who we are and what we want to do in the world. And they also, the subtle body also carries that karmic element, what we have done in the world. And we're going to talk about that a little bit more. We'll talk about, there are, Prabhupada mentions it, not in this verse, but the next verse, that there are four stages of sinful action and reaction. And so this is part of the whole system of living in the world, doing activity. That activity is not happening in a vacuum. It is not happening unobserved. That activity is witnessed not only by the supersoul within our own heart, but it's also witnessed by a whole entourage of demigods and so forth. And they adjust our future based on what we're doing right now. And what we're experiencing right now has been already adjusted by what we did in the past of this life, and in previous lives. And that's why, obviously, we see that people don't have the same kind of fortune. You know, some people, whatever they do seems to work out. They make some plan for some kind of material, you know, happiness, and more or less it seems to pan out. And other people, no matter what they do, nothing gets off the ground. Everything seems to flop. And in fact, they seem to be beset with tragedy after tragedy, and reverse after reverse. And so this is all part of the stream of past karma that is being reprogrammed back into the present life. It came from the past and is being reprogrammed into our present life.
So in between the two lives, mm-hmm. What preserves the subtle body? You know, what preserves the, there must be some energy needed to preserve it in some way.
Yeah, it is a kind of subtle essence, you know. From our modern scientific viewpoint, we usually study earth, water, fire, air, ether. End of story. That's what the scientists study. That's what the physicists study. That's what the chemists talk about. But there's three material elements that are even more subtle than those things. And those material elements are called mind, intelligence, and false ego. And they work as an integrated triplet. And they work together to take the soul from one body to another. They are a kind of very subtle energy, if you want to call it that. But it's even more subtle than the kinds of energy we usually talk about. Yet it's still material, because it has a beginning and an end. And it's only a part of this material world. This subtle body does not exist in the spiritual world. We don't need one.
So it's more of an energy field?
Yeah, something like an energy field, right.
Is there a way for people to tap into that energy field?
Yeah, to some extent, like I say, people experience them when they experience ghosts or this Kirillian photography, that kind of thing. This is that part of human anatomy that so far medicine doesn't really deal with, and the scientists really don't deal with, because they don't like this kind of stuff in general. They have a very truncated view of the world that we actually live in. And so therefore they're also unable to explain all kinds of phenomena, because they are just, you know, on a mere prejudice, rejecting whole categories of existence. And because they're rejecting categories of existence, they're also unable to explain phenomena that are generated by those categories of existence that they've rejected artificially. So when a person dies suddenly or is murdered or tragically commits suicide, such a person tends to get propelled into the realm of ghostly life, where one has a subtle body but no gross body. That's what a ghost is. It's a person with a subtle body but no gross body. That subtle body is not the soul. That subtle body is a subtle body. And so a person in that state of existence has to go through some purification, and eventually they get moved back into having another gross body. And when they get moved into another gross body, they can continue their sojourn through many incarnations until they finally come to spiritual life and leave the cycle of reincarnation altogether. Any other questions? Yeah.
Actually, your last point kind of made me think, can you still get karma in a ghost body?
Yeah. Yeah, you can still get karma in a gross body, in a ghost body, right. And people do. As a matter of fact, for the most part, people in ghostly bodies are very disturbed because they have the same desires that we do. In fact, there's no real difference in that sense from us. But they don't have a physical body, so they can't experience the material things that they want without a gross body. Instead, what they do is they play with people's minds, because that they can do. So that's why ghosts generally create disturbances, because they want experience, they can't have it in the usual way. And so instead, they get it vicariously, and they get it, you know, by, you know, creating problems for people. And that's what they do. That's their main activity. So just try to understand those basic concepts, that we have free will. And because we misused our free will, we come out of the spiritual world. We come where? We come here, to the material world. The minute you come to the material world, you get, you know, your prison uniform. First is the, subtle body, and the next is the gross body. And then with both of those, you wander around here as long as you want. You'll never be rejected from the prison. You can stay here as long as you like, until finally one day you realize it's a stupid way to waste your life, eternity. Let's move on. Let's get out of here. And to get out of here, you learn, like we're reading here, the Supreme Personality of Godhead said, because you are not envious, or Arjuna, I will now impart this confidential knowledge you know, and you will be able to get out of the material world, and you will also be released from the material miseries. Okay, so we've talked about some of the things here I wanted to cover. Let me see what else. So envy is a primary blocking force here. So anasuyave, actually, in Sanskrit, which is means non-envious. So I guess suyave is probably the Sanskrit for envy. There's other words, matsaram. That's another word for envy. We basically leave the spiritual world because we are given free choice. We do not have to serve God. We do not have to see God as the center of everything. And if we do not choose to see God as the center of everything, God does not complain. He simply complies with our desire. But to not see God in the center of everything, we can't do that in the spiritual world. It's not practically possible there. But it is practically possible here in the material world. Here it is possible to ignore God. And the material world is designed to help us do that. It's not an accident that God appears to be nowhere. It's a design feature. The material world is designed to hide God, and it does it very well. But when you decide that you want to realize God, then God helps the material world to gradually become more transparent to where you can begin to see that it is actually his energy and everything working is under his control. But if you don't want to see that, the material world is very opaque. It hides God at every turn. And that's why when people say, I don't believe there is a God, or God is dead, or there can't be a God, I believe them. I believe that's the way they see the world. That's the way they want to see the world. And the world is presenting that very opaque illusion to them. And as long as their desire is very keen in that way, they are not going to see God, and they are not going to have any connection with the idea that anything could be coming from God. Of course, no matter who you are or how atheistic you are, at some point along the line, God does, you know, pop up and say, oh, remember me? Oh, I'm going to go away again. And what was that? Well, I'm going to get rid of that. I don't know. I must have ate something, you know, so that was disagreeing with my constitution. That's why I saw that. But I won't think about it. So Krishna keeps popping up like a jack-in-the-box here and there. And, you know, eventually we get the clue. Eventually we are just, you know, dirt tired of going through the ridiculous motions of following various material, superficial, two-dimensional dreams that never amount to anything. And we decide, well, if these superficial, two-dimensional dreams never amount to anything, well, what really is it all about? And then we learn about Krishna, we learn this confidential knowledge, and we decide, oh, that's what it's about. And we begin to turn it all around. And as we begin to investigate spiritual life, we begin to understand at least the theoreticals of who Krishna is, the theoreticals of how to perform devotional life, then it starts to make sense. We begin to practice it. And we get the experience of the material world starting to become more and more transparent. We begin to be able to see through it. We begin to see what it really is. We are not bewildered anymore by its opacity and by it pretending to be something that it actually is not. Any questions about that before we go any further?
Well, is this one of the reasons why, you know, a lot of people say, like, religions are failing? Because when you come across a person that is in doubt about the issue of existence of God or the realization of God, but then when they talk to some of the religious leaders, they fail to, you know, bring out the importance of, you know, letting God or the spirituality resonate within their body, so they have reflection and understanding how to maintain, you know, the laws and the will and the practices that they're supposed to have.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, Like, we have a lot of spiritual leaders, but, you know, we're still dealing with this element of this battle between good and evil because,
right.
You know, a lot of people don't really want to, they're allowed, like you said, they hide God and they're allowed to accept this practice of being disobedient as far as dealing with the issue of social laws. I mean, that's why we have all these stupid wars going on, right?
Yeah, so that'll always be there. It'll get better sometimes, it'll get worse sometimes. But only until someone's serious about trying to investigate God are they going to change that, you know. So as long as one is firmly convinced that material happiness is possible, they will never take up spiritual life. God will never be any significant part of their life, and they will continue in the cycle of birth and death, sometimes getting into very nasty and ugly kinds of consciousness and selfishness, and sometimes being more kind of nicer or pretty about their, you know, material selfishness and so on. But in any case, it's going to be material consciousness.
I understand what you're saying, but it is really dealing with the problems of our relationship and what is the truth behind our spiritual world and how it interacts
with
our material world. So that deals with the mentality of our relationship.
Right. So first you have to get the theoreticals down. That's why we're discussing things in a class like this. First we get the jnanam, or the theoreticals of how we're explaining the Vedic literature. The Vedic literature is explaining this to you. I'm not making it up as I go along. This is what the Vedic literature is describing. And once we grasp these concepts, then we try to put them into actual practice. And we begin to realize that this is really what's really going on. This is not somebody's, you know, mental dream that they're projecting out on the world and they want everybody to follow their way of looking at the world. It's not just a perspective of the world. It is the perspective of the world. So wherever you go, whoever you are, you will constantly encounter all kinds of different philosophies. And so you can work your way through experience, talk about, try on various philosophies, but you won't come across anything like this anytime or anywhere else that explains the totality of what's really going on with very practical things that you can do to remove the illusion and the confusion of everyday life, and also, as we see, remove the miseries of everyday life. That's what this is all designed to do. It starts with theoreticals, and it moves into practice, and then you get the vijnanam, or realization. If you don't do any of those things, then don't expect any of those things. You will continue in a cloud, going from one lifetime to another, never quite understanding who you were, who you are, who you're becoming, never really understanding why you're here, what this place even is, why people go through life the way they do. You won't understand any of those things. You will just have various fuzzy notions about these things, and many people do. And when you become serious about spiritual life, then you start to recognize that it does have something to do with God. And if that's a problem for you, if it has something to do with God being is a problem for you, then you won't get very far. Because as Krishna is saying, if you're envious, then whatever you understand will never be very deep. It will always be a part of the murky opacity or the opaqueness of this material world that will hide who we really are, hide who God is, hide the mechanism of karma and the whole business. We won't see it. We won't know it. We'll just be batted around like a tennis ball in a tennis match, you know, from one end of the court to the other, never really knowing why we're experiencing suffering, never really knowing why we die, never really knowing what was worth anything or what this place is. You have a question.
It's about envy.
Yeah.
How Krishna tells Arjuna he's going to explain this knowledge to him because he's not envious.
Mm-hmm.
So it means, like, for us, we have envy. So how can we understand God in that way? How can we understand Krishna? Because envy is there.
Well, we have some envy, but we're at least ready to put some of it aside, you know. So it's a question of degree. We are not obviously completely unenvious. If we were, we'd be pure devotees instantaneously. But at the same token, we're not so envious that we turn away even from the idea of studying something about God. So there are people who do that. You know, in seventh chapter of Bhagavad Gita, we heard about, you know, four kinds of people who never turn. You know, the Maya Prahita Jnana, the Asuram Bhavamashrita, the the Bhutana Mudha and the Naradama. You know, so those are people who are envious enough that they don't want anything to do with God. So those kind of people, they won't get any kind of understanding of the world that they live in. One thing they will know is what kind of sense gratification they like the most, and they will have a definite plan for how to get that. That's one thing that people who don't know anything else about the world, they always have a crystal clear idea of that, you know.
Is like incorporated within the subtle body
that
covers us.
Right. So that, you know, those are the five things that we try to get away from. You know, lust, anger, envy, illusion, madness, etc. Those are the negative qualities of the humans that we are trying to rise above. You know.
So they dissipate slowly.
Right, they dissipate slowly. With devotional service, we are actually doing exactly the thing that envy would keep us from doing.
Okay.
So we are, you know, by degrees exercising that envy from our consciousness. You had a question.
Yes, I have one question. Last Sunday I went to Shalimar to the temple.
Uh-huh.
Could you please give us definition of, I don't know how to pronounce it. It's D-E-I-T-Y, deity of Krishna.
Deity.
Deity of Krishna, yes.
Yeah. That is the Murti form. You see in the temple, when you were there last week in Skimmerhorn, there's the Radha and Krishna deity there. They're called Radha Govinda in Brooklyn. And so Krishna is a supreme person, and Radha is his consort.
What do you mean,
consort? Consort. She is the pleasure potency of Krishna.
Thank you. I didn't know that.
Yeah. And, of course, we are still in the opaque material world, and we are not pure enough to be able to see the original Radha and Krishna. So Krishna creates a system where we can see him and Radha in a form, either made of marble or brass or papier-mâché or even drawn in sand or in wood or a number of different kinds of mediums. And by worshiping that form, we begin to conceptualize God as a person, and we begin to develop a relationship. And that form is called technically in Sanskrit Archavigraha, which means the Lord in a physical form. Of course, Krishna is in everything. He's here too, in the, you know, wall or in the floor, whatever you want to look at, it's all Krishna. But in a Murti or an Archavigraha, Krishna agrees to be specifically present in that particular form, because by serving and viewing that form, we begin to awaken a sense of service relationship with the Supreme, which normally would be hard to do because we're not qualified yet to see him directly face to face. We will one day be, but we're not yet. So this is the intermediate step that we can take. And so the process of deity worship is one way to begin that process of reconnecting with the Supreme. Did that answer your question?
Yes, thank you.
Okay, yeah.
I just got a question. This one, what you said.
So what is the difference between, like, specifically being in a Murti versus just, like, is that a more potent form of Krishna?
Yeah. So in the process of, this brings us to what my next section was, so I'll just kind of blend it in with what I had next planned to speak. Because Prabhupada talks in the end of this purport about the nine processes of devotional service. Does anyone, I hope somebody does, know what these nine processes are? Just name one of them, not all nine.
Shravanam.
Shravanam, what is that in English?
Hearing.
Shravanam. What's another one?
Kirtan.
Kirtanam, what is that?
Chanting.
What's another one?
Smarnam Vishnu.
Yeah, Vishnu Smarnam. That's what in English? What's that? Remembering Vishnu, yeah. So we've had Shravanam, Kirtanam, which is Shravanam is hearing, Kirtanam is chanting. Vishnu Smarnam is remembering Vishnu or remembering Krishna. What's the next one?
Pada Sevanam.
What is that?
Serving the lotus feet.
Okay, serving the lotus feet. When we do some practical service for the Supreme Lord, that's called Pada Sevanam. We cook something, we clean the temple, we perform some kind, we are witnessing some kind of activity going on for the Supreme. We offer some money, we offer our time, we offer whatever expertise we have in some occupational endeavor. We use that for the Supreme. That's Pada Sevanam. What's another one?
Archanam.
What's that?
Worship.
Worshipping what?
The deity.
Right. What we were just talking about. When one worships the deity, that's a type of devotional service. Now, archanam can mean a very specific kind of worship that the pujari does on the altar. So when you go to a temple, you'll usually see the pujari performing what we call is artik. You know, artik means that you offer various items to the Supreme and you do it in a very structured and systematic way. You begin by offering incense and then you offer a ghee lamp or the lights and then you offer the water and then you offer the cloth. Then you offer flour. Then after that, you offer a chamara whisk. And if it's summer, you offer also a peacock fan. And so this is part of a system called deity worship. But even really, in one sense, those people who are watching the artik, they're engaged in a lower form of archanam, or the deity worship. They're also participating in it. So this is one type of reconnecting with the Supreme. So we were talking about, theoretically, that this knowledge will deliver us. This knowledge is not given to anyone who is envious. This knowledge is going to deliver us from all miseries and so forth, you know, and this knowledge will give us realization. So the actual practical end of it is, it has these nine possibilities of what we can do. So we've talked about Shravanam, hearing, Kirtanam, chanting, Vishnu Smarnam, remembering, Pada Sevanam, serving, and we've talked about Archanam, which is doing deity worship. What's one more? We've still got some left to go.
Manavedana?
Yeah, that's the top one, the last one. That's giving everything to the Supreme. That's a very high form of devotional service. What's another one?
Vandanam.
What's that?
Vandanam,
what's that?
Offering respects and prayers.
Offering prayers. So Vandanam is offering prayers to the Supreme Lord. So those first six are the real practical types of devotional service. The last three are more elevated forms of devotional service, at least as far as I can tell. So we talked about one of them, which was Atmanivedana. So what are the last three? There's two more left.
Dasyam,
what's that?
Servitude.
Becoming a servant. And what's the last one that we haven't talked about yet?
Sakyam.
What's that?
Sakyam.
And what's that?
Friendship.
Yeah. So becoming a friend to the Lord, that's not something we can do at this stage, but it can be done and it should be done later on. But we can become friend, we can become a servant, we can give everything to the Lord. Those are the real high forms of practical devotional service. So, at any rate, these nine processes of devotional service are what is actually the bottom line that Krishna is giving to Arjuna. He's explaining to Arjuna that because you're envious of me, I will impart to you this most confidential knowledge. And what is that knowledge of? It's of these nine activities. And if you do these nine activities, you keep your life always being engaged in one or more of these things, then there's no question that you will become purified and you will get the vijnanam, the realization. And when you get the realization, then you will rise above the miseries of material existence. Any questions about that part? Okay. Nobody has any questions about that part. All right. So, Prabhupada, in the purport of this verse, he describes different kinds of knowledge. So, normally, when we hear the word knowledge, we immediately think of technical, usually occupational knowledge. And, you know, when you see the word written somewhere on a sign or a billboard, it's always in that context. What do we get knowledge about? We learn how to do electronics, or we learn how to engage in auto repair, or possibly we learn how to do IT or something like that. So this kind of technical knowledge, everybody has no problem with understanding what it is and why it is. But this knowledge is actually basically all for one purpose. All these kinds of technical knowledge generally are done for one overarching purpose, and that purpose is so that one can get some remuneration. We can be paid for having this knowledge in our minds, be able to do it, and when we're paid, then we use that money to get whatever material things we think are most important. Whatever material experiences we have as being the things that we're really focused on. So we use this occupational, technical knowledge to gain material assets. And with those material assets, we deploy those assets for our material experience that we optimize according to our own imagination. And that's what's going on in the world, 99.9% of the time. People are getting technical knowledge for that. But here we're talking about a different kind of knowledge. And this knowledge is spiritual knowledge, where we're learning that the real purpose of the world is not to just rack up more and more material knowledge for material practical benefits and then deploy those benefits for our material happiness. No, that's not the real purpose of the world. Rather, we can use and should use whatever occupational or technical knowledge we might come by, but we should use it to please the Supreme Lord. And so the material world turns from a whole, like smorgasbord of various things we use to please our own senses to a toolbox of things we use to please the Supreme Lord. How do we please the Supreme Lord? By these nine processes of devotional service. We learn how to take whatever we know, whatever we have, and then rearrange it instead of just to figure out how it will maximize my particular happiness the way I understand it, to how I can use this in the service of the Supreme. Can I use it in Shravanam, in hearing? Can I use it in Kirtanam, in chanting? Can I use it in Vishnu Smarnam, remembering the Supreme? Can I use it in some kind of Padasevanam, using it as a service to the Supreme? Now, we take the items in the world, and we take the knowledge we have of the world, the technical knowledge, but we apply it in a different way. We're not using it to maximize our material happiness. We're using it, rather, to please the Supreme. And of course, in the very beginning, that's a big struggle. It's artificial. We find ourselves, you know, with a lot of uphill battle. But it gets easier as time goes on. And as we become purified by devotional service, we no longer find it so much of a struggle. In fact, we like it. In fact, we're happy doing that. In fact, we become so focused in devotional life that we lose sight of material happiness. We no longer really just think about it day and night the way we do now. So it's a gradual process. We learn about these nine processes of devotional service. We learn about this most confidential knowledge. And now we try to put it into practice. And by degrees, we find ourselves changing how we see the world. What we change is also how we deal with the world, what we do with the things of the world. And we also learn how to change everything, whatever we do as human beings, to a practical type of one of these nine kinds of devotional activities. So in the beginning it's a little difficult, but later on we become more and more practiced at it, and we find that we're actually happy doing that. We find that it doesn't become a harder and harder struggle as time goes on. In fact, it becomes an easier struggle. And at a certain point we find ourselves losing real interest in the material world the way most people see it, losing interest in these vague plans that we had, that we carried around for so many lifetimes that we thought were so important. Okay, so any questions there? Oh, yeah.
This is kind of related and kind of unrelated in one sense. The fact is that Krishna has the things that we want as souls, so that's why we become envious of him. Right? Mm-hmm. So it seems like, why does that happen if we're part of him? Like, why do we get this kind of, you know, jealousy popping up? It seems odd, right?
Yeah, well, it's the exact opposite of love of God, you know.
Right.
So we have this binary option. That's because we are souls. We're individuals. If the only thing we could do was love Krishna, then essentially we would be robots. You know, we would have no free will. And something that has no free will also can't really love, because love means that one decides. As opposed to not loving, one makes a voluntary decision to love. And so this is what not loving means, that one is envious. Instead of wanting to relate with Krishna, we want to be Krishna. And of course, we're tiny and Krishna is the whole. We can never be Krishna. But Krishna is so kind that he gives us a world where it does look like we're Krishna if you kind of close your eyes good. You know, you don't really look too close at things. You can kind of get away with that myopic view of the world. But it's possible in the material world. It's not possible in the spiritual world. Krishna is just too front and center for things in the spiritual world. But here it is possible. And so that envy is the opposite of love of God. You know, it's how we manifest our non-love of God, you know. And as long as we want to keep that, we can't have love of God. And if we want to have love of God, we gradually give that up. Right now, we're kind of batting back and forth between the two options. But as devotional life becomes more purifying, we find that we're more on the side of loving Krishna and less on the side of envying him.
I once asked a question, you know, whether there's something deficient or wrong with the souls that come to the material world as opposed to those other souls who
don't come here.
Basically, they don't come here, but they never have the sense of jealousy of God pop up even. So how come? I mean, it's like we're all parts and parcels of Krishna.
Yeah.
None of us are not parts and parcels of Krishna. Some of us all of a sudden get this, like, you know, sense of jealousy towards Krishna, and a lot of us don't. It's so, I mean, it seems almost random in one sense.
Well, it might seem random, but it's based on free will. I mean, more than that, I've never read anywhere other than, you know, we have this basic thing we call free will.
Right.
Free will means you have two options. And when you have two options, obviously some people can take option A, people take option B, you know.
Right.
And some have already taken option B and come back. And we will one day be in that category. But some have never taken option B.
I'm wondering if there's something wrong with me because of that. You
know, well, we chose the wrong option, what can you say? Once you're back in the spiritual world, it hardly matters. As, you know, we talk about...
it's like a dream or something.
Yeah, yeah. We talk about there's three categories of liberated persons. You know, there is sadhana siddha, there's nitya siddha, and there's kripa siddha. You know, so... once you're back in the spiritual world, it doesn't matter which of those categories you are. They're all the same. As Prabhupada said, you know, when you're looking at a blue sky, does it matter that 15 minutes ago that had clouds in it or 15 minutes ago it didn't have clouds in it? You're still looking at a blue sky. So it's the past is irrelevant at that point, especially the past in the material world, which in the spiritual world is like a flash in the fan, you know.
Right, really quick.
Yeah. Yeah.
Can you please elaborate on those three categories you just mentioned?
Well, the spiritual world, we see a kind of schematic of it there. That's in the center of the lotus, that's Krishna Loka, where Krishna carries out his intimate pastimes with his most intimate devotees. And outside of that, in the blue, we see some effulgence that we call the Brahma Jyoti. And that whole area is called the Parivyoma, or the spiritual sky. Those planets are spiritual planets where the Supreme Lord is worshipped in the mood of servitorship. And there the Supreme Lord is visible, but in a four-armed form. In Krishna Loka, he has a two-armed form. And in Krishna Loka, he has intimate pastimes. And... the living entities are innumerable, but they have free will. So they can stay there either in the spiritual planets where Krishna is in a four-arm form, or in Goloka Vrindavan in the center there where he's in a two-arm form. Or if they like, they have free will, they can leave. And if when they leave, they come to what you see right below there. That's our beloved material world. That's what it is right there, that dark area. And there, there are innumerable material universes, of which we are in one. And in each of those universes, we have many planetary systems. And we, as a result of our desire to be Krishna instead of serving Krishna, we are allowed to incarnate there in some kind of form. And so sometimes we see that living entities choose option B. They leave the spiritual world from one of these planets or from the center planet. They come to the material world. And when they come back, usually the reason they come back is because they have done what we are trying to do right now. We are doing sadhana, which is these nine processes of devotional service. Sadhana means a practical approach to purifying our consciousness, and that's called sadhana. Sadhana also means regular. It's not happening, you know, once every, third month or something like that. It's happening daily. Sadhana is something we're doing on a daily basis. And by performing that sadhana, we become purified and we go back. And then we're called sadhana siddhas. We came back. And we became siddha, which means perfected. So there are some living entities that are nitya siddhas. They never came here. So such living beings are called nitya siddhas. And then there's some who did come here, and they went back as a result of performing sadhana, which is what we're trying to do. And then we become sadhana siddha. Some come back to the material world And they get special mercy of the Supreme Lord, and they get ejected back to the spiritual world. How exactly that works, I've never heard a lot of details about it. But that's what's called kripasiddha, or someone who goes back to the spiritual world as a result of some specific mercy. All right, so those are the three categories.
So how far are these planets physically from Earth? Are they part of the Milky Way galaxy, or are they in a different
galaxy? No, they are completely outside of the material world. Everything we see is within that black spot down there at the bottom there. And even that black spot is all the universes. We're only seeing one of them, you know, that we're in. And so those universes bubble out of Mahavishnu, and they're each one is separate and encased, so you can't see to another universe, what to speak of the spiritual world. So all this is, there's no way to get to the spiritual world without becoming purified. There's a barrier, which we call the Brahma Jyoti. So to go to the spiritual world, you have to be purified. And to do that, you have to follow the nine processes of devotional service. And then you're eligible to go there. Otherwise, there's no physical way you can go there. You can't get in some kind of rocket ship or something like that. That's not feasible. Even if we could go, even to the extent of our galaxy, we couldn't get that far. We couldn't, and we can't even do that. Okay. Any other final questions here? We'll... I was going to see if we could get into the next verse, but I don't have enough time to do it justice. The next verse is a very important verse. So I'm going to leave it for probably Atma next week or whoever else is. Yeah. Okay.